room at McCormick Seminary. Ruben, I'm going to talk to you about some shared themes, some shared Chicano themes, and there will be 12 of them, and we're going to just, I'll just go ahead and read the my statement or question, and then you just give me some feedback or development on each of these issues, themes actually. Number one, Exodus, fifth chapter, first and second verse. Let my people go so that they may keep a feast in the wilderness in honor of me. Black theology, African theology, and Latin have used this from the Old Testament as a starting biblical point. In Exodus, against much opposition from Pharaoh, Moses led the Hebrews out of Egypt. Without God's help, Moses would not have succeeded. What are your thoughts on the Exodus event in the Old Testament as compared to the cosmic oppressive experience with the Chicanos? Is the Exodus theme a viable theme for Chicano theology of liberation?
I've given a lot of thought to that. And at first I was very intrigued by the Exodus theme, in that Exodus theme one has the whole imagery of slavery, exploitation, abuse, marginal people in a particular society. Then I begin to think, Andres, that if we use the Exodus theme, we're really negating historical reality in a way that, if you remember, the War of 1848 really was a way of appropriating our people. And if one uses the Exodus theme, then one admits that one is a stranger in another. In other words, Moses came to liberate the people from the land of Egypt, to take them to a promised land. The problem that I find is that we are already in our own land. If you're talking about the Chicano, you're talking about the whole Southwest, you're dealing with a piece of real estate that was taken during the Manifest Destiny period from Mexico, in which we already belong. So I find a difficulty in using the Exodus theme. Think about letting my people go. There's some very good imagery there in that people are held in captivity, people are held against their will, people are not allowed to practice their own religious understanding and culture, and yet there are some limitations to the theme. And I've wrestled with this a great deal. Is it proper for us to use that theme, let my people go, or is it better to speak only in terms of captivity, not in terms of saying, let my people go because this is not our land, but in terms of speaking about we are still held in captivity in land. You understand what I'm saying? See, I think there is a danger of using that imagery and bringing it to here when we want to say, because of President Polk's insistence on manifest destiny, because all the Congress of the United States was so bent on acquiring, we are the new Israel, we are going to acquire all of this land, and we are destined to bring enlightenment to all these people. The war with Mexico was fought, and we became citizens because of that acquisition. It seems to me that there is a problem there. How do we resolve that? How do we speak about liberation in terms of land? In terms, I'm not sure. I haven't really come up with the answer, except to say that we must be very careful that we do not negate the fact that we were here first. Mm-hmm. You understand what I'm saying?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, I believe that for the blacks, it has a lot more meaning because you see, the native to this part of the country, native to this continent, and in that sense, there is a sense in which they can claim that in a certain way. But I think there is a difference when we talk about ourselves as Chicanos.
So, in other words, this thing could be the same thing could apply to South, right?
Oh, yes.
Because they're in their own land.
They're in their own land.
So that for them, this event would be found with the same type of reality that you're, with the Chicanos are confronted with.
That's right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I think that's a that would present for them a problem in saying it is like the Exodus, but it is not, in the sense that we are already in a look. Think of the Mexicanos in the Southwest. You know, I mean, they are all, the Mexicano does not recognize that border, and why doesn't the Mexicano recognize it? Because it's part of the land historically. Okay.
Only a political border.
That's right.
Not a real border.
It's not a real border. Psychologically, the Chicano does not recognize that border.
Mm-hmm.
You know? You can call it, in that sense, a man-made border. But in our minds, it's not that. So that if we are talking about being held against our will, as the Israelites were held against their will by the Israelites, we are held against our in our own land, directly parallel. We are held, and that makes a difference. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's a very fine, you know, it's a distinction
no, it's
a, I want to keep.
But
it's a very fine, you know.
I can see a big distinction. But at the same time, I can see a.
Yes.
Wrong with that.
That's right. Yeah. Exactly.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Almost all Chicano Catholic homes in Nevada of the Southwest display Pe. Almost all Chicano Catholic homes in Nevada of the Southwest display Guadalupe's picture. Experience of the Chicanos. The role of the image on the Nuna de Guadalupe is one of a strong experience of the Chicanos. The role of Miss Helping Hand to the Poor is one of a strong symbolic spiritual mother who is always there to lend a helping hand to the poor. One is only to look at the gruesome crucifixes of Guadalupe's churches to deduce that Christ is one of us. Hence, the concept of Guadalupe's churches, Liberator and Mother of the Chavez, have also become very real to us. As Emiliano started off institutions of government and capital.
Andres, here I am as a Protestant. As a Protestant. And my pilgrimage to understand the concept of my thesis and Mary in the Latin one. And I wrote that thesis, and now after under the influence of the mission as being under the influence of the missionary sent them, so that if you were to read my thesis today, that's to say that I believe the person have not appreciated the symbolism, because it has a very deep in that tight where in that tight where Virgin appeared to Juan Diego is the sign, and that peculiar revelation, but also there is the expression of a peculiar revelation, but also there of an identity that is not captured by that is not captured, so that the Virgin of Guadalupe takes on now. Let me give you an example. When I was in national character, when I was in the service in the Navy, I was a Protestant. I've been a Protestant all my life. But I hadn't. I've been a Protestant all my life. Also, with me during the Korean War, who were also with me during the Korean War, who were also. And it was very interesting that the one rallying thing that identified us was the unifying factor, was the idea that here was a unifying factor, was the idea that here was a symbol. Protestant, that meant us. Now, Protestants have been very, Protestants in particular, very conservative people in the Protestant faith have been very reluctant to identify the Virgin of Guadalupe. And I think it is an identity. The fact that, because it is an identity, the Virgin, the fact that the Virgin is brown, even Virgin, that even people, see, even people in Tierra del Fuego, way down south, prior to the coming of the Spaniards, were already worshiping. There is a consciousness, makeup is already present. Hispanics and in our makeup. Theologically, as a Protestant, theologically, would be heresy for me. Theologically, to admit, let's say, to a Presbyterian in promoting the understanding a contention. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, for the Hispanic, I find a very sad lacking. The Hispanic is always identified primarily with the mother. Mm-hmm. And I know, for example, the mother. My father is a strong figure that when it comes to is an authority. When it comes to the feeling of the heart, when it comes to the when it comes to the feeling of the heart, when it comes to the what I'm willing to die for, say to me, is something against my mother, not my father. I didn't say anything. And see, I think Protestants, and I have to speak. Their heritage, appreciated. Their heritage. This is in dogma and doctrine, and so on.
Yeah, but I think this
is in dogma and doctrine.
Identity, did you mention?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think of the song with this, Ser Guadalupano, Ser Guadalupano. Para el mexicano, es algo esencial, Ser Guadalupano.
Exactly.
So that there's a,
oh, yeah.
Es algo esencial.
That's right, really, exactly.
It goes beyond religion.
Exactly. Yes.
There's more.
Identity.
Religion.
Exactly.
It gets into the.
It's an identity.
Yeah. It's the nature.
Right. The nature of who we are. That even though we were Protestants or Roman Catholics, when it came right. That even though we were Protestants or Roman Catholics, when it came right down to the nitty gritty, we were for La Virgen y mi madre. There's a real strong sense of unity there. The strength. Let me tell you, it's also very interesting to probe psychologists, but to probe the idea of the strength that comes from the mother figure.
Mm-hmm.
If you recall, read Portillo's book on Aztec religion,
mm-hmm.
and that the Aztecs had a duality to their gods, which mm-hmm. is mother and. Which was mother and father,
mm-hmm.
which was female and male,
mm-hmm.
and in the Judaic Christian tradition, there's been a strong father figure,
mm-hmm.
you know, God, and so on. Feminists have challenged that, but they're not new to the issue. The Aztecs had already figured that out. And we have not capitalized on, as Chicanos, mm-hmm. on what that has contributed to our own heritage. So that as a national identity, our strong identity is towards the mother. Mm-hmm. And Guadalupana would be is a natural. Mm-hmm. Is a natural. Mm-hmm. So what I'm trying to share with you is the paradox that exists with Roman Catholics have no, their identity is already very firm in that area. Protestants. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Does that give you any?
Yeah, that's good.
Okay.
Number 3. La Raza Cósmica. José Vasconcelos, a Mexican upper-class intellectual, introduced the term in 1925. His book, La Raza Cósmica, Misión de la Raza Iberoamericana, was published in Paris. In dealing with race, class, and national issues, this book is very controversial. It has not been translated into English. No le conviene al anglosajón que este libro sea traducido, at least not from a Mexican neighbor. The imperialistic tendencies of North America are early disclosed in this essay. Vasconcelos wished to find common ground and a common identity to establish some kind of political and spiritual cohesion in Latin America, which was being economically divulged by European and North American interest. Moreover, Germany at the time was persecuting the Jews and advocating by actively toying with natural selection of human beings. Chicanos had been downtrodden for nearly 150 years in the Southwest, adopted the term La Raza, a rallying cry for unity and justice during the 60s and early 70s. A resurgent pride arose in being Chicano and a member of La Raza once again. In your opinion, what are the positive and negative aspects of this symbolic concept? In our present day reality, what new light, if any, could we shed on it? Absorbing the historical development of this concept, is it a viable symbol for liberation?
I think that I've used this image of Vasconcelos, La Raza Cosmica, in two ways. And the first is that I have felt that Vasconcelos was attempting to find a common denominator for humanity. Mm-hmm. And that common denominator was not based on a specific racial group, but was based on what in this society in the United States would be termed, and in other societies would be termed, miscegenation of the races. That is to say that Vasconcelos was trying to point across that the Hispanics represent all the rainbow colors of people.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say that once you are brought into the family, once you belong to the family of La Raza, color is not an issue.
Mm-hmm.
Color is not. There is something more than color that binds you. But most of the problems that you encounter, for example, are racial problems based on color.
Mm-hmm.
But across the board, with Hispanics, as you look at the whole spectrum, you will have from very white to very black. And yet there is a bond. An example, Puerto Ricans who come to the United States who are black Puerto Ricans,
mm-hmm.
They don't identify with the black in the United States. In their soul, they're very Hispanic.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll find a more common bond with those who have a Hispanic culture and speak the language than they do with the black. They'll never identify with black. They'll always be Hispanic. Why? Same thing with people who are very white but who are Hispanics. So Vasconcelos was attempting to say that in some ways for me, that we as a Hispanic people, being La Raza Cosmica, that we represent the whole gamut of the human experience. Now that's on one basis. Theologically, for me, it has a certain eschatological dimension. One thinks about the kingdom of God as a reality when people will not see those differences. When I think about it in terms of a new creation. What does Paul say about a new creation? What does Christ say about a new creation? If we are all the family of God, does the family of God speak in terms of racial groups, in terms of ethnic groups? No, it speaks about a whole family of God in a diversity. And so what Christ is attempting to do in the coming kingdom is to establish, in a sense, that understanding that we all belong to the family of God, regardless of our, you know, where you want to peg it in a kind, in this, as this racial group belongs to that racial group. So, in a very sense, if we want to speak about a new group, Vasconcelos had it, their way, la raza cósmica. For me, you know, that's very powerful. And I like to put it in contemporary terms. In fact, in a paper that I wrote, alluded to the fact that this presents a whole new dimension, particularly for those who want to speak about white supremacy, who want to speak about racial supremacy, that one cannot talk that way in New Testament terms. One cannot talk that way even in Old Testament terms. So it's very important for me to press the idea that Vasconcelos had, that I'm reminded, you know, of Paul in Galatians, in Christ there are no Jews, no Greeks, you know, no free, no people, no women, no men, no women, whatever, but that we are all one in Christ, and in a way, that is the new creation. That it, Hispanics represent the new creation in some ways, because they cut across lines. You can look at yourself, you can look at me, you can look at a Puerto Rican, you can look at a Cuban, you can look at other people, and we can all be sitting in a room, and we can have different features, different colors, and yet we have one common language. A common heritage. What if you translated that theologically, which is the ideal? But I think for the Chicano, I think it's critical. The Chicano does not look at in some ways, at color. What is important is that you belong to a family, to a raza.
Let me ask you this. A lot of times, you know, because Vasconcelos, you know, kind of places the European, the Espanol, you know, town, the Indio right here, and the black town.
Yes.
It's a tragic flaw in the sense, in him, in that sense, in the sense that he's trying to say what you're saying, but at the same time, he lives in the 1920s.
Exactly.
When Hitler was persecuting the Jews and advocating racial supremacy. And there's the tendency and the temptation to say, look at it this way. Strategically, we place it, sure, the Spaniard is more intelligent than the Indio, let's see, lower, el negro, abajo. And some whites, primarily, have monopolized on this as, that's reverse racism. Now Vasconcelos is advocating a type of a supreme race like Hitler was doing in Germany, now he's doing it with the Hispanics.
Yes.
How would you address that issue there? How would you, and I say a tragic flaw because Vasconcelos did the trap of saying that, you know.
That he makes a hierarchy.
Yeah, a value.
The white and then the
Indio and
then
the
Indio and the black. To follow all our, it's a natural conclusion if we were to follow all our, it's a natural conclusion. Conclusion, if we were to follow all our instincts, in other words, status or racial look, and either to other people, we follow a racial group as a natural and natural conclusion. And natural, a certain kind of hierarchical understanding, or in his own thing. He was striving to articulate in his own way. And that would include everyone.
Especially the second. Yeah, because he does say, in some of his writings, especially the second. Yeah, because he does say, in some of his writings, especially the second book, he mentions that, in some of his writings, especially the second book in the Elohia, he mentions that.
He brings it out very, yes, he does.
Part to the back.
Right, because in the back of his mind, it out very, yes, he does. Because in the back of his mind, as I try to understand him,
inevitable, right?
That's inevitable. And see, that.
Inevitable, right?
That's inevitable. And see, who subscribe is what people who subscribe to one particular.
The dormants.
Yeah.
Those
would not want to have.
The dormants.
Yeah.
Those that follow the British and the
Germans.
Yeah,
and see what the future would be in that the world is shrinking. No? Communication is greater. Shrinking. No? Communication is greater. People will have a greater ability to cross as they did not. That contact will bring mixing, if you want to call it that, you know, in a way, he would be a prophet. A prophet in the sense that he forced that the solution, which was cosmica, that is to say, a problem was to establish a rasa, which was cosmica. Cosmic, after all, you know, people don't have any, and that there would, after all, you know, people don't have any problems in mixing genes with another group of people. It's not as if we were dealing number of chromosomes, and it's not as if we were dealing with dumb animals and or lower forms of human beings. Human beings can come together and produce, and they're, you know, make chromosomes. So in a sense, if we look at it from a scientific point of view, what will bring us together? Look, Hispanics have that. You see, you can look at people white, okay? Uruguay, very particular, or Paraguay. Very particular in the sense that there are many Germanic people who came there. Now, these St. Mary's at Notre Dame, Professor Harold Weiss at St. Mary's at Notre Dame, who is a Puerto Rican. Harold Weiss considers himself a Hispanic, a Latino, uppermost. See? You have a little bit of raza cosmica there, German Jew background. His children are, he is German Jew background, Latin American Jew.
Mestizos.
Mestizaje. It's really a very key element to it.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting also that a lot of professors from Latin America that have German last names, Domingo Mestizaje, and some other ones, French. They don't consider themselves French or German. They're Latin Americans. They're either South American.
Why is
like Goldberg or Mexican? It's like
look at those.
Why is like Goldberg name?
Latin America.
Argentina.
Okay.
Latin America.
And very Hispanic. And prefers that. So I think Vasconcelos had a, I would like to do that. And for me, theologically, I would like to do that. Develop on the God and create yourself. Of God, which is something that.
Okay. article, The Chicano Movement, mm-hmm. Machismo y la Mujer. Leo Di Nieto, in his article, The Chicano Movement and the Churches in the United States, Leo intends to deal with the issue of the oppression of the movement and the churches in the United States. He intends to deal with the issue of the mission of Chicano unity between the sexes is not States. If the matter of the equality between the sexes is not resolved, then none of us are free. And that comes from Leo's. If all Perkins School of Theology Journey, and that comes from 19 Di Nieto's. What steps can we take against the fallen concept which dehumanizes society? And I guess I say the machismo concept from another concept that, I guess I say, dehumanize it. Mm-hmm. From another concept that might not dehumanize it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Leo. And I've known Leo from me. Again, I think there's a, again, you know, as Hispanics and as males who are gay, that we as Hispanics and as males who are gay, there's this certain machismo. That it is certain machismo. And I see this in many areas. To promote the liberation when we ourselves have not been in areas. To promote the liberation when we ourselves have not been in. How can you promote liberation of women in our respect or against? We face the same thing. And that doesn't mean that you're against the liberation that Hispanics have a greater handle on the liberation of women and have not really gotten hold of it. And that is that really system, although it seems to be patriarchal, it's really more system, although it seems to be patriarchal, mm-hmm. much more. And that once we release that power, recognizing that we will be further ahead in the United States of white dominant society, in the United States of white dominant society, reverence for the woman, great, tremendous reverence. For the tremendous reverence. One of those, it's what but again, it is, can we as Hispanic males speak about Hispanic women liberation when we are not liberated? Mm-hmm. Dominance. That doesn't work towards it. I think much of the machismo that is exhibited in our own society as Hispanic exhibited is really a front to the rest of society. It's only when we, as the society, males become, when we as Hispanic males become comfortable of our own identity that we're able to, our own Hispanic, with, I do not believe that us think our women is inferior, or as Chicano. I really don't. It's just that we in a society have known the opportunity to say, hey, you know, our partner is equal, just like we.
Yeah, but the
you understand what I'm saying? I think
yeah.
That's a.
Yeah, but the thing was coming to.
You understand what I'm saying? I think
yeah.
That's a.
Yeah, but that's a liberation, correct? Mm-hmm. We can't liberate. People have. The person himself or the mm-hmm. we can't. Liberation.
That's
the agent has to live.
That's right.
Has to seek liberation.
That's a form of chauvinism.
Right. That's another form of
that's
oppression.
Right.
Huh?
That's right.
So that the women have to.
The women have to reach their own.
But that what you said about. That.
Oh yes.
Because it's like the golden rule. I mean. Part of the problem because we've never seen, and that I think has been part of the problem because we've never seen. Women something has been part of the problem because we've never seen
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then when capitalistic heritage the biblical heritage and the capitalistic heritage
mm-hmm.
and the Catholic Church itself, the
mm-hmm.
magisterium for instance,
mm-hmm.
Then you can see the roots of the stereotype and the roots of the how easy it is to fall into the trap.
Oh yes, it's very, very easy. I think that we have not really even paid attention seriously to. I think that we have not really even paid attention to our leaders and judges.
Or even among the Indian tribes,
That's right. I do believe exactly that in a way where we have a better handle is that in a way if we can couple. I think the power lies, or at least the understanding lies, in this sense. See if I can explain it. For women, in terms of the reverence which we have for women, in terms of mother person vows, in terms of a resourceful person vows, in terms of a all that is matriarchal and all that is matriarchal understandings, right? Understand, encouraging, we're in the our own way of deliberating. Not that we, it's really false, like you say, to say now, I give you your freedom. But if we can encourage that kind of self-consciousness, bolstered by the fact that we already reverence for that, we have a reverence for that. I think we can dispel. I have a difficulty under the whole business of machismo, because it's been a heavy trip laid on us as Hispanics. And it doesn't really, it isn't exclusively ours.
Mm-hmm.
No. Although it has the name machismo, which is Hispanic. And, white males are the same. I don't know what you would call them. But they've adopted our name. And in a sense, it has a derogatory implication for Hispanics, because normally they think, well, you're more macho. And yet, then we are. White American woman. In the middle has rebelled against their own. It has rebelled against their own male.
You probably also have more white middle class educated women than you do minority women.
That's right.
Don't you? So
yes.
That has a lot to do.
Sure, it has a lot to do. It's more threatening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. Number 5, racism, classism. Are people use the term todos hijos de Dios or todos hijos del diablo? How would this statement relate to the issue of racism and the issue of classism? Latter Penang Laoji has said that the real issue is class, but in relationship to the government. In relationship to the government.
Violence is defined in terms of destroying property or injuring someone, physical harm and so on. And yet, violence can take many shapes and forms, which have nothing to do with harming somebody physically. Violence can be a psychological one. And so that if we talk in terms of violence, if I am for violence in the sense of pursuing justice, then I would opt for a violence that is not harmful to the physical body or the destruction of property, but violence that shakes the status quo, that is to say, in a confrontative way. On the other hand, one cannot rule out altogether physical violence. See, that's an issue that people have raised about liberation theology, saying that, well, liberation theology sometimes advocates a physical violence, and that you're more for the leftists than you are for the rightists, and that if you are for the people, then you will support the leftists, and that means providing with arms, and that means killing people, and that means all kinds of stuff. In our own society here, in the United States, as Chicanos, I think physical, harmful property violence is ridiculous. In that the reality that faces us is that we can be squashed at any minute. Let's say, for example, that 200 brown berets decide that they are going to arm themselves and violently, physically react against the state capital of Texas. Well, what chance do you think they have? You know, they'd be squashed immediately. Or if you armed all the Chicanos. Okay? A violent revolution in that sense would have no meaning. It's just the same thing as saying, well, I'm gonna go up against this institution and violently oppose it when it has a $20 million endowment and you have $10 in your pocket. Okay? Who's gonna experience the violence? You are, with $10 in your pocket. But on the other hand, you can create a consciousness, which is also a form of a violent change in people. And so I like to think of violence in terms not of property or physical, but in terms of creating a different consciousness. And if I do violence to your consciousness, I attempt to do it in a sense that it is constructive, in eradicating the old values and modes and so on, and in that kind of shake-up to bring you around to a different consciousness. In that sense, I think violence is legitimate. Mm-hmm. Make that clear?
No, yeah, I think that for people to become, I can see how I use the word violence, mm-hmm. to become conscious of their
right.
own existence is mm-hmm. a violent act.
It's a violent act, yes.
Because I have to, I mean, it's not something that's not going to hurt.
Exactly, you know?
I mean, it's going to hurt.
It's going to hurt.
The whole process, you know, we talk yeah. in theological terms, the whole process of metanoia is a violent.
You go one way and all of a sudden you turn this way, all your energies, metanoia means, you know, going one way and turning around, coming the other way.
Yeah.
Change is always
or
violent.
This way, then take
exactly, off. And take a right angle direction. Yeah. You bet. You know, it's violent.
Yeah. But I guess when we use the word nonviolence and violence, we're talking about political terms.
Oh, yes.
In that sense, violence, you're right, would be wiped out.
Mm-hmm. It's nonsense. It would have no chance.
Yeah. Nonviolence, like Chavez.
Well, look at Tijerina. I mean, what chance did he have? You know, he shoots Tierra Maria, and the next thing you know, you got the National Guard after him, and then, you know, they got him.
Yeah.
You know.
Really. Well, number 10, the land. The question of the land is a very touchy one because whoever controls the land controls the people living upon it. Nevertheless, the people have an affinity with the land that is almost sacred. New Mexicans have land grants which the federal government refuses to honor in spite of the Guadalupe Hidalgo Treaty it made with Mexico in 1848. A large number of Chicanos are migrant workers who farm the land of agri-growers and multinationals. The agri-growers get richer and the migrant workers get exploited and poor. How does one reconcile the affinity of land with the spirit of the people in the bid toward liberation? Is there a strong message or messages here which we have not theologically or spiritually emphasized to break the change of fatalism and inferiority complexes which too often haunt and destroy our people? How would you utilize this idea? Or is the idea good at all given the time in history and the Anglo-Saxon who in reality occupies the land of our ancestors, both Indians and mestizos? Should this thing be investigated for the purpose of liberating the spirit from its oppressive counterparts? Emiliano Zapata's revolutionary motto was Tierra y Libertad. What does this mean for Chicanos 60 years later?
I have a tremendous amount of difficulty with that personally, because I've, you know, dealt with looking at the issue of land and how you look at all the Spanish land grants and you read the history about how these were taken advantage of, and now they're in the hands of a few and powerful, and they're recorded and all the legal laws are with them, and so, you know, how can you fight that kind of thing? And on the other hand, I read Walter Brueggemann's book on the land, and where that becomes a very strong identity for people. I don't know what the answer is to that for the Chicanos. It's true. As I look at, let's say I look at South Texas, and I look at south of San Antonio, and see that 99% of the population now is Mexican, you know, Mexican American. And yet the power and the wealth and so on is held on by people like former governor of Texas, and people of that. What chance do we have by legal means, any legal means, to become people of the land? Very little. In reality, we have very little. I believe the only way that we can identify ourselves with the land is not in terms of ownership, let's say so many acres and so much, mm-hmm. but more in terms of political, mm-hmm. more in terms of political and influential power. Mm-hmm. See, we need to face the realities. There's no way that we're going to reverse, let's say, the way that the King Ranch acquired its land, right? All of that mm-hmm. is set forth. No court in the United States, no legal court, would even hear an argument on those terms. Mm-hmm. But, on the other hand, if politically you're able to wrestle the power, then you can have control over it, whether you own it or not.
That's true.
See? You can have the say-so on how the resources of their land are used if you control the political. Take a situation like Crystal City. See, in a moment of history, mm-hmm. Crystal City was able to control not the spinach, which is the spinach capital of the world, mm-hmm. but it was able to control how that was used. See, and that, I think, is the key. Not so much that we own it. Mm. It is just how we're tied to that land to see how its resources are used. Mm. For me, that's much more realistic than to say, well, someday we'll acquire all that land. We won't. I don't think. It's just as the same parallel could be said, like, we'll never get a slum back. Mm-hmm. But see, we can control it.
Control the political power.
Right.
But there's a problem here.
Okay.
And the problem is, and this is where I said the land is sacred.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that there is an affinity with the land that the people have, especially the poor people.
Yeah.
In the fact that they farm the land, even though they don't own the land.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
In the fact that they're buried in the land.
Yes.
And that the fact that the whole concept of the Mother Earth, you know, mm-hmm. that the Earth mm-hmm. is the Mother.
Mm-hmm.
And if we go into the Indian,
mm-hmm.
you know, background that we have, it wasn't so much the ownership of the land as the resource that the land provided for the Indian, the corn, the squash, the you know, the livelihood that came from it. Because we remember most Indians didn't own the land. It was communally owned.
Right.
Tribes owned the land, but not any individual person owned
the
land. So the whole question of private property comes in, becomes a central issue to the economic base of the society.
That, you know, that's why
which
I
is what Marx develops later on. But anyway,
that's why I say that politically you can control the means of production. And even though you don't own the land and you have an affinity with the land and you know that the land or Mother Earth produces for you, what ultimately becomes of utmost importance is not whether you own it with a title deed and so on, but whether you can produce, whether you can control the means of production for the benefit of the whole. And that's an affinity to the land. No, that the land...
Yeah, it's going to be pretty rough.
It is rough. It
especially with
a
capitalistic government. Huh?
Yes, very, very rough. But see, and again, that's an idealistic thing, but I see the only... What solution do you have? Let's say, for example, what solution do you have that a particular corporation that is doing business and owns this all this land will eventually use those resources for the good of humankind? Is it to take it violently over? Now that's unrealistic, we've said that already. Is it to become owners of it? Well, that's unrealistic because you don't have the economic power to do it. You can't. Or is it to become politically power wielding, that you can decide how those productions are channeled? Now see, I think that last alternative is tied to the land in a sense that you recognize the goodness of the land, but you've taken the historical situation. The only way you can do it is through a system.
Mm-hmm.
Without resting the deeds and the titles and becoming owners of the land. Because, see, once you become owners of the land again, you have the danger of becoming an oppressor.
Mm-hmm.
See? So, given our own reality, I think the only way is being able to determine the uses of that land, whether you own it or not. The issue is not whether you own it. The issue is the uses of that. For me, at least.
Thinking about the fact that, you know, the fact that you're on the land, the fact that the rug is pulled from under you through a manifest destiny,
right?
And you're left there, tirado, and then how do you get back up again? And you're saying, don't even worry about the rug. That's not the issue.
Yeah,
which, I mean, I can relate to that.
Yeah,
I mean,
see,
I tell you what, I can relate to you, to that up to a certain level.
Uh-huh.
And that's up to the level of consciousness that we were talking about.
Right. Uh-huh.
But we're talking about a group of people who don't even know that the rug is pulled from under.
Right.
And that's the majority of people who are not educated, who are not politicized, who are, Jesus, man, like the blind leading the blind. And I think we're the blind leading the blind.
That's right.
Because we're up here,
yeah,
going with the criticism, coming the other, and saying, well, what are you talking about authenticity or originality? When all you're doing is giving these people European ideas that you've acquired in the intellectual process, that you have acquired in this, 4, 8, 12,
right,
13, 15, 20 years in college or whatever. I mean, the criticism is legitimate.
Yes.
Because we're all European. Gustavo Gutierrez is European.
Yeah.
James Cone is European.
They drove for all.
All our educated
leaders
are European, let's say. But I still continue. That's not the issue. And unless we can get the message to our people, liberation, and how we utilize the tool of the land, say.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk to Tijerina, the whole different tool for him, because he's got proof. But you're right. Most of the land, and he's fighting the government. He's not fighting an individual.
That's right. That's right.
Family.
He's fighting the government.
He's not fighting the King Ranch.
Oh, no.
He's not fighting Briscoe.
No.
He's not fighting the Haciendados, you know, the Spaniards
mm-hmm.
can still have land in New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you know, cheated some of the poor people out of the land grants. The Indian, too, cheated out of the land.
Mm-hmm.
He's fighting against the government.
Mm-hmm.
And the government, what has he got to stand on other than, all right, you're right, we did take the land, you know?
Yeah.
Which is legit, which is a good strategy for say, New Mexico. But what about South Texas?
Yeah.
Where 80% of the people, como dijiste, or Chicano, 90%, 99%, and 10% of, it's like South Africa, 10% of the people are so
own
the education, the economic, the politics.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, how can you control that? See, let me tell you something.
So
Reyes Tijerina has 1 million acres, okay? He can only work at 60. Okay. Granted, you know, this is a concession that he got, so. Supposing that we were able to wrestle some kind of concession on the government to give people in South Texas 1 million acres to a few people, would they economically be able to make it feasible? Would that give them the worth and the power? Or is it, I think it's unlikely, I really think it's unlikely that they would get that anyway. We have to deal with realities. And I think the reality is in the political power to decide on how that land gets used. I don't care who owns it. How does it get used to the benefit of the people? And that involves a lot of things. That involves equal pay for migrant workers. That, you know, that involves tax bases. That involves whether those people are getting farm subsidies and where you know how those get distributed, or whether it resides in one individual. All of it has to do with how do you decide it on a political basis. Because in reality, we can't own the land. We can't.
Or the argument that arises, well, we got enough land for everybody. I mean,
yeah.
It's just, it's not practical to say we're going to give an acre to there's more people than there would be land.
That's right. There'd be more people than there would be land.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not practical. Not practical at all. Doesn't make sense. I lean more towards the political cloud and the decision.
What about the psychological and the spiritual?
Well,
I had to come and pound this question, but there's something there that's not, you know, that the only way you can really.
I think psychologically, our people would not have any difficulty.
Hmm.
Psychologically, our people are very landed people, very close to the earth. Very, and it doesn't matter who it belongs to.
That's right there.
No, it doesn't.
Mm.
As long as it produces.
Mm.
See, I realize, for example, let me give you an example. I've got this property here, and on the other side I have about 20 feet of real nice land that I plant my garden for my family, okay? On there, I plant corn, beets, cabbage, tomatoes. Very small, but you know, we enjoy eating those.
Mm-hmm.
I have a big mortgage on this house. Chances are, you know, that I'll never pay this mortgage, like no one else. You know, how many American families finally pay their mortgages on their house? The records show that there are very few people who finally end up paying a 25, 30-year mortgage and own their place, okay? Economically, it's not feasible. People will buy here and then sell this one, buy over there. They'll never ultimately own. Now, So in a sense, see, this is not mine, it belongs to the bank. Right?
Yeah.
But I have the decision to see how I use that resource for the benefit of my family. Mm-hmm. Now multiply that. See? There's no way I can wrest this property from the bank by saying, you know, you owe it to me. I'm a Hispanic. You know, I was here first. And, you know, I mean, that's a mute argument. Okay? But on the other hand, I make a decision on how this is used for the benefit of my family and my heirs.
Mm-hmm.
See? There's a parallel there. I think that's part of it.
Okay. Let's get into 11. Get over the two more.
Okay.
The Catholic Church, Sacrament of Liberation or Opium of the People. Many Chicanos have left the church and have joined Protestant churches because the church refused to face the real issues that affected the needs of the Chicano community. Others have been married to work within or outside the church for changes in the life and destiny of the Chicanos. What are your thoughts concerning the Catholic Church and the lives of the Chicanos? You can see that this is a Catholic question more than a Protestant question.
But I really believe. See, this is an issue that I'm working at. My own personal observation and feeling is that the Roman Catholic Church, the Catholic Church, has been more active and more aware of the Chicano plot and more willing to get involved in the Protestant Church. That's my, as a Protestant.
Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example.
How many Protestant centers are there to help undocumented in the United States? Hardly any. Almost all are Roman Catholic. Okay? In all the movements, beginning with the farm worker movement, beginning with the fair, having to do with the fair strike, having to do with Cesar Chavez and so on, the mainline Protestant denominations, and even those sectarian, were the ones that were most against it. And I'm speaking as a Protestant. Our biggest enemies, those of us as Protestants who were involved in the liberation of the Hispanic, were told, you're a radical. What you ought to be concerned is about the spiritual. Never mind that. Okay? And so that 10 years ago, I said, the hope of the Hispanic in the United States lies in whether the Roman Catholic Church will be relevant to the U.S. to our plight or not. That's a radical statement for a Protestant. But by and large, I think some of our Protestant denominations are beginning to catch up. But as a Protestant, looking at the Roman Catholic Church, I see more involvement of the Roman Catholic Church with the real issues of our people than I do the mainline Protestant denominations. And I feel that it's my task to move our Protestant denominations more closer to the commitment that Roman Catholics have to our people. And that's an honest appraisal. It's a battle I'm being fighting for.
What comes to mind is, you know, Cesar Chavez's struggle in California,
mm-hmm.
where it wasn't a Catholic church at first, because many of the growers were Catholic.
Yes.
They were Italians, and mm-hmm. they were Polish, mm-hmm. and they were, mm-hmm. Catholics.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the church just stepped back, and the Protestant church came in.
That's right.
And, but that's an exception to what you're saying.
Yeah.
You're saying, like, in Houston, in San Antonio, right. Chicago, New York.
Right. Uh-huh. That's right.
Then Florida. That's right. Another good example.
Uh-huh. The Protestant Church. And this is one of the reasons why Latino Studies exists, is because we're trying to form pastors of Protestant denominations, but not exclusively, who will be sensitive to the needs of our people.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the problems that we have encountered within the church has been that we don't have unlike the Protestant denomination, there's no viable native leadership.
Right.
And historically, mm-hmm. the church has always, you know, mm-hmm. kind of downtrodden the mm-hmm. native population. Mm-hmm. Like when it came to New Mexico, when it came to Texas, when they mm-hmm. came into California, mm-hmm. the first thing they did was replace the native clergy.
Right.
And they never made an effort to mm-hmm. build it up.
And see,
but yet the social consciousness has always been there.
Oh, yes. See, and I think that's a strength that the Protestants can lend to the whole enterprise, is that we are raising
native clergy.
Right. We are raising mm-hmm. native clergy, as opposed to the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
And so that a strength we can lend is raising that native clergy.
Mm-hmm.
It could be a compliment.
We would have the social consciousness.
Right. we would have the leadership.
Leadership, right.
Exactly.
Because the way we are now, we have the leadership, but you don't have the social consciousness.
Exactly.
We have the social consciousness, but we don't have
but no leader. No indigenous
so
leadership.
Parece la maldición, ¿verdad?
Yeah. Parece la maldición.
So that
but sometimes when you bring it together, you'll have a powerful force. That's our attempt.
Yeah, because let me tell you, the way I would feel right now, you as a Protestant, I would trust you much more than I would some of these Irish bishops. Forget it. I would have been at the table, yeah, I would. Like when I talked with, who was it? Not too long ago. Opo Ricardo Sanchez.
Oh, uh-huh.
I had a lot, much more faith in Ricardo than I do with some of the professors, you know, that taught me in St. Thomas or the seminary. Jesus. Because they would fight more against you than with you.
Oh, sure.
Because see, the problem is I saw them in the seminary was that, okay, we were being trained in a certain framework,
mm-hmm.
an Irish framework.
Mm-hmm.
But even within that framework, I could see that the way I was going to apply this theology I was being trained in was going to be different because the needs were different.
Oh, sure. Definitely.
But when you try to do that, they call that false doctrine.
Oh, yes.
Or they call that codio sociology or political science.
That's right.
But it's not. It's theology.
It is theology. Definitely.
But it's just that it's not Irish.
Uh-huh.
It has to. Because the Irish need is not the need of, say, of when the Irish start first, because probably they had that need then.
Oh, sure.
And that was it. Well, the big criticism of the Irish have been they have never produced any intellectuals. Lonergan has been the first one. Oh, my goodness. But anybody see, most of the followers of Lonergan are all Irish.
Are all Irish, yeah. Yeah.
And those that are Chicano and Black are also Irish. Black yeah, Irish.
That's right.
Chicano Irish.
They've turned Irish. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But ours, nevertheless. Well, anyway, that's for another time. That discussion needs more development. Number 12, this is the last one. Theology. This is theology until recently in Latin America, Black, USA, Asia, and Africa was always written from the perspective of the conqueror colonizer. This perspective always expounded universal truth in categories and theory. In practice, however, it always left out the peoples of different colors. It's theology. I should add to that classes too, different class. Its theology also addressed and sought to meet the needs of those colonizing as opposed to those being colonized. Hence its cosmic vision was lacking, or rather its universal characteristics were never developed enough to include those being oppressed. Instead of an inclusive cosmic totality, there existed only a universal partial totality. Hence the complete problem and need was not entertained in the discussion and research. In other words, the dominant theology left out those oppressed. Instead, it addressed the needs of the oppressor and colonizer. From my own experience, what would such a theology teach us?
Clarify that a little bit for me.
Okay. In other words, the dominant theology left out those oppressed.
Yes.
That's the dominant theology.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, it addressed the needs of the oppressor and colonizer.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Which means it left us all out.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That theology, from our own experience, what would it teach us?
Well, that theology would teach us that there is a danger in working from absolutes or in working from propositions or axioms that are unrelated to the reality of people. Because when you are able to work with propositions and axioms, you can establish a sense of superiority But if you begin with the praxis, with the level of the people, then you begin to reflect from your own circumstance. For example, if you can make the proposition, God is love, okay, and say that's a theological axiom, God is love, then those who are in power can say, well, you know, the reason that we are in power is because we love God, God loves us, and that way we do whatever we want to do. Whereas if you look at a situation from the experiential of the oppressed, and you raise the question, okay, so God is love. How is God love? Where do we see God love manifest? You begin to raise all kinds of questions of, not necessarily, I am now justified to do whatever I want to because God loves me, but what is my responsibility in that love of God? What is the challenge that comes from that love of God? It's a totally different perspective. The way I do not believe that the established doctrines that we have been accepted, proposed to us as axiomatic, are necessarily relevant to us in the liberation process. You know, I just don't. I think we've come to a point where we have to say, as I would, as a Presbyterian, and taking, let's say, for example, the Westminster Confession, which makes a statement like, God is infinite, eternal, omnipotent, omnipresent. The minute I start thinking about that, I say, well, you know, all of those things are the things that I'm not. That's a way of that's deducing. It's a deduction method of saying who God is. Right? On the other hand, if I begin where I am at and I raise questions of why do my people suffer? Okay, what kind of God is this? Right? That's a totally different perspective. Mm-hmm. The founding of the United States, in some ways, took on the perspective of the axiomatic, and that is to say, there are many sermons to this effect. And Robert Bella, for example, in his book, Broken Covenant, that's a great deal of it. In that people looked at the United States, who were coming over, as the New Jerusalem. They were leaving the old Babylon. They were the promised people. God, in his sovereign right, had decreed that they should, you know, own all of it. It was part of the manifest destiny thing. See, that's operating out of axiomatic propositions. And I don't think that we, as Hispanics in the liberation process, can afford that. When we talk about God is love, I think we're raising a question. And that it's not an axiom, it's not a proposition, it's a question. God is love. And what follows from that is, how do you see it? How do you do it? God is eternal. How do you see it? How do you do it? God is infinite. God is omnipresent, always present. How do you see it? How do you do it?
You remember one question I always had was this. We were always told who or what God was. No. Who we were. We were never told how we were to be.
That's right.
And then we were told you're a Christian. But we were never told how to be a Christian.
That's right. And that's because it comes from, see, you are a Christian is an axiomatic proposition. Mm-hmm. The question is, How is it practical? It begins here, where you live.
Yeah, how are you going to be a Christian?
That's right. How do you do
it? Because a lot of times people just, well, with the predominant theology, it says, okay, it just stops there. You're a Christian.
That's right.
But it doesn't follow through. It doesn't, mm-hmm. just leaves you with the identity, but it doesn't leave you. But it leaves you without the purpose or the
yeah,
the,
or if it
or the eschatology.
That's right.
See, where are you going?
Where are you headed?
And how are you going to get there?
Yeah. See, if
you just can't be. You have to do.
The other thing is what it does is it says, okay, you're a Christian, and then it gives you little rules, you know, boom.
To substantiate.
To substantiate them, okay.
Or support it.
Yeah, see, that's deductive thinking. That's, you know, you've got it all down there. Whereas, I think we're saying, you're a Christian, so what?
It's done upon me.
So what?
Okay. Hans Kuhn's book, what was the title of it? That's interesting.
Yeah.
That comes into mind.
Yeah.
His book was on being a Christian?
On being a Christian.
On being a Christian is very different on than and yet it's really it's tricky.
Mm-hmm.
On being a Christian could be the same thing on what is a Christian.
Yeah.
But it also could mean what it means to be a Christian, and then you have to understand how to be a Christian.
That's right. And then you have to answer the question, so what? So what difference does it make?
Mm-hmm. Then we make a lot of difference.
A hell of a lot of difference.
Because you could take a Puritan stance, say in the early 19th century, of the early 19th century, and says that would come
on
the politics of God, right. That Washington talks
exactly.
about.
So yeah, you got them all down, and an absurd thing is, you know, the spiritual laws, you know. So you got all these little spiritual laws of Kemper's Crusade or whatever. You know, that's the other absurd. Yeah. And you basically have to, for me anyway, is to raise a question, okay, so you are a Christian, so what? You know, what does that mean concretely in your life, and how is that going to work out? Well, there is no
then
path.
You're not, so you go to a different level. Then
that's right. Yeah. And there is no path for me.
No. And I think that what has happened to this dominant theology is it hasn't left that realm.
Mm-hmm.
And what liberation theology does, it goes into the realm.
This
it takes that leap of faith.
Liberation theology, almost says, look, that's irrelevant because it doesn't really speak to your concrete situation. You've got to start here. And I believe
the
that.
The inductive method.
Yeah, right. Or experimental or whatever. Or yeah.
Inductive.
Method.
That's the way it's called.
Yeah. Rather than deductive.
Another question comes, can you have the inductive method without the experience? Because it's definite that you do have the deductive method when you don't have the experience. You don't need the experience because it's revealed to you.
I think you can have the deductive method because in a certain sense we are unique, God's creation.
Right.
And part of it you can attribute to the image of God, the Imago Dei, or
mm-hmm.
all whatever you want to say about that. And yet, you know, that's only really a part of the gift.
Mm-hmm.
See, if you consider it a total gift, then that can lead you to egotism and self-sufficiency and ignorance of responsibility for neighbor. But that's not what the witness is all about. First of all, one has to recognize that God has not left his or herself without a witness, period. Okay? That's there. Once you dismiss that, and you accept it and dismiss it, then the burden is placed upon you. How do you, who are a creature of God, reflect the glory of God? How do you reflect it?
By loving my
neighbor. That's right. And that's the law and the prophets, and everything is fulfilled in that.
So. Yeah. But the criticism of the European theology is that first of all, that's not theology. But
mm-hmm.
liberation theology is not theology.
Well, of course, yeah.
But it doesn't address the issue of the how,
mm-hmm.
which is indirectly being addressed by the inductive theology, mm-hmm. which would be the liberation theology.
Sure. Definitely. Yeah.
The other question that arises in my mind is that is such a process possible without the experience? My answer to that, well, I don't know what you would say, but in other words, can somebody in Europe write a theology that would be relevant to somebody in Africa, where the experience is totally different, or Latin America, or Asia?
You see, they could put forth some propositions that would be valid.
Well, that's been a missionary enterprise, hasn't it?
Yeah,
Protestant and Catholic. Right?
Yeah, they could put propositions that could be valid.
Mm.
You know?
My God, it's not.
Yeah, could be. Yeah.
Or God is a supreme being, say.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. But
there's something missing right now.
A little piece there's missing. How do you perceive that? And how do you, in your context...
Or how are you going to tell this peasant who's starving...
Exactly.
...that God is the supreme being? He goes, who cares who God is?
God is love. You know, who cares who God is when I'm starving?
Yeah, right.
Same.
Or sick. Or dying. Because you don't have the proper health.
Yeah.
Hijo, man.
Está pesado. Well, does that get it?
That's it.
Someone is done.
Yeah. It raises interesting issues and problems that mm-hmm. have to be dealt with.
Yeah. Right.
Especially this last question, which is.
It's a real thing, anyway. I'll tell you.
Okay. Gracias.
Okay. Bye. Okay.